Recording from New York, WETA Radio now presents Inside Gene Shepherd.
Yeah, I'm really singing good, you know, really. Hey, I did you see there was a picture in the paper here the other day of, just to start right out here and get right at the nitty-gritty, which in our world today is showbiz. Our world is based on showbiz, really is. In fact, sex has become showbiz, crime has become showbiz. Showbiz has become showbiz. Oh, it's all showbiz, theatrical. You know, it takes one heck of a magician to turn somebody into a pillar of salt, I'll tell you that. That's a scene, I'd love to have seen it. I mean, you know, water is parting and people, oh, wow, burning bushes, I'll tell you, that's all showbiz. And you got to accept that, you know. It's part of the pageantry of human existence, right, gang? The agony and the thrill of defeat. I must say that the other day I was looking in the paper there, and there's a picture in the paper of Burt Lancaster. And let me adjust this thing here. And Lancaster looks almost exactly like the late and the later stages of his career, Ernest Hemingway. Oh, yeah, he's got a giant white beard, you know, he's got that baseball cap bit, you know, and he's going into that whole scene there. And I guess guys get into that avuncular stage, you know, and they see themselves as the great sage. And so he was talking about, you know, the fact that this TV show he did, they're going to run it on 6 successive weekends in the summertime. And he's really bugged. He says, who the heck hangs around and watches television in the summer? Well, TV freaks. I mean, I know people who look forward to their two-week vacation now so they can watch television 24 hours a day. They don't have to interrupt it by going to work, you know, and all that stuff. Oh, yeah, it's madness. But which brings up the point that my television show goes back on the air the 12th of July, in case those of you who missed it the first time around. Yeah, it's on the PBS, which locally here, I guess, is 13, right? And, of course, I don't know what time they'll broadcast it locally. It goes on the network at 12, and they tape it. You know, some stations will play it at 2 in the morning. Others will play it, opposite Cannon, and all the rest of it. So it's going to run through October. So, there's some hope for the summer then, right? Sure, what the heck. You know, speaking of of showbiz, hey, do you know that there's a town, my spy out in out on the West Coast, he sends me these great dispatches, you know, from the underground. He operates a submarine, this friend of mine, and he's got the only submarine in Palm Springs, California. It's not much business, actually, you know, it's a desert out there, And so he thought it would be a big tourist attraction, but it isn't. And he takes people on, you know, rides and stuff. He's got the only submarine I know that operates on wheels. Yeah, he found out there was no water at all around Palm Springs. A heck of a disappointment. So now all he does is he just drives around, and people get in, and they put the periscope up, and, you know, and he hollers, fire four tubes, you know, or blow out the torpedoes or whatever they holler, you know, up periscope, down periscope, dive, dive, you know, doing, 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 the bell goes. And it's very exciting. But he keeps me informed of what's happening out there, see. And he says that, here's a piece that he sent me from the L.A. Times, and it's from Kelso, California. Well, you know who Kelso was and is. Yeah, Kelso, you know, the great horse there. Sure, Kelso. Kelso, speaking of Kelso, one morning I was out at Belmont Park at 5 o'clock in the morning one morning. And I tell you, that's morning. Oh, boy, I tell you. And all these guys wearing, it's a, no matter what kind of weather it is, see, whether it's middle of summer, whether it's middle of winter, the racetrack types, the real racetrack types, which are little short, heavy-set guys, always wear dark suits and fedora hats, which you think probably went out of style with Jimmy Cagney, but not so among the real racetrack cuckoos. They sit way up in the dark part of the stand up there at 5 o'clock in the morning with these big binoculars, and they watch everything that moves. I saw one guy, for example, with a stopwatch, and he was clocking a mole that was crossing the track. And, you know, I told him, I said, say, I says, what's with the mole? He said, you never know when he's going to run. And I said, oh, okay. And I have to keep track of everything out there, if I may use the phrase. You track, you get it, well, really good. So that's worse than Phyllis Diller. So nevertheless, he was sitting out there, see, tracking his mole. So I walk out on the track there, see, and was nice and soft and kind of gooey. They had just run the rake over the thing, see, and it rained a little bit the day before. And all of a sudden, I hear blump, 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 and I see coming right at me is Kelso. He's out there on an extended run, and he goes tearing past me. I'm one of the few people you know who has had mud kicked in the face of himself personally by Kelso, one of the great horses of all time. So, you know, I enjoyed that. So a couple of months later, I go back out there, and I got mud kicked in my face by another great horse, Carryback. Now, you know, you know what I think would be terrific? How they have, you know how they have All-Star Day? Not All-Star Day, really, but they have Old-Timers Day out at the ballpark, you know, and they bring back all these old third basemen. And, yeah, they always, you know, they hear the PA system is constantly announced. A little echo chamber now, you know. And now, ladies and gentlemen, number 17, a great all-star second baseman who played from the year 1922 to 1937. Number 37 coming out on his field now. Let's give a hand to Charlie Gehringer, the great shortstop and second baseman for the Detroit Tigers. You don't know who Charlie Gehringer is and was. Well, he was a great second baseman. He was a carry back of second baseman. See how fame is? Well, that's the trouble. See, half the crowd sitting out there are all Mets freaks, and, you know, all they do, the only time they go to the ball game is when it's T-shirt day, so they don't know what from baseball, you know. So here you are, you're introducing Charlie Gehringer, and they don't know what they're seeing. You know, they see this old guy with the white hair. But nevertheless, I think, you know, everybody in baseball recognizes that the all-star or the all old-timer game is a big draw, see. So there's, and television, of course, goes in for that at big. I mean, every couple of days it seems like they're bringing back George Burns, you know, and they bring back Groucho, and you know, they wheel these old guys in, and they make their little funnies, and they wheel them out, and everybody cheers. So it's all part of that scene, but it doesn't seem to be part of racing. And can you imagine a day when you go out to the racetrack, and they've announced that before the big race, they're going to have all these old-timers day, and led by, say, Secretariat. They just walk around the track in their original colors. Wouldn't it be a great idea? You see, and riding him would be, of course, a jockey who rode him during his great period of winning. So here's, you know, here's Ron Turcotte out there. He's riding Secretariat, and they bring Kelso. You know, Kelso's around yet. Nashua, Carryback. Boy, wouldn't it be fantastic? Each one, you know, dressed in his own original colors. I don't mean race them. You know, just take them around there, you know, that people would cheer. I'd pay to see that, you know? I really would. And I'm not a betting freak at all. I just love to watch horses. I used to date a lot of horses in my time. I'll tell you. In fact, still do. But nothing like going out to a track, you know, watching those, boy. But a Secretariat is a beautiful horse. But I'll tell you this, speaking of great horses, I had, now, I hope I'm not boring you with this horse scene, but seriously, have you ever had the chance, to involve yourself with any kind of a real champion? A lot of people, you know, they'll see a champion on TV or something, and they're kind of, they're remote, of course. They're always being interviewed by Howard Cosell, who was always asking them about their religion, you know, various very pertinent facts. He never asked them about their left. Muhammad Ali, it is said that you know, and never get down to just, you know, what he's doing about that left hook. And, the fans don't want to know any of these technical things. So, unfortunately. So, one time, well, I've been involved with a couple of champions. One time I sat and had dinner, a very odd evening, with a man who was the National League home run hitting champion. In other words, he led the league, maybe six or seven times, hitting home runs. And we were sitting there, and we were both that night eating stone crabs, in case you want to know what champions don't necessarily eat Wheaties. He was eating stone crabs cold with cold mustard sauce. Very elegant evening. With a little white Alsatian wine. It was kind of a nice evening. We were sitting there, and he was discussing, we never talked much about home runs, but he had hit all these homers, and he really was a legit champion. So, a couple of semesters before that, speaking of champions, I just walked into a party one night, and a bunch of my friends were everybody hanging around, you know, eating the Frito-Lays and hollering at each other and yelling and the smoke and all that. And in the middle of the crowd, I found myself suddenly talking to this guy, and then it dawned on me who it was, the ex-heavyweight champion of the world. Who was that? No, for God's sakes. You're going back to the year 22. Good God, John L. Sullivan, what are you talking about? Who the hell do you think you're listening to? No, it was Floyd Patterson. And he had just packed it in, and he wasn't anymore, you know, he wasn't champion any longer, but he had been champion. But now, the only champion that I personally have been involved with in action was really something. Twice I've had actual experiences where I was involved with a champion. One time, I was playing in a Pro-Am golf tournament. And you know, when they assign you to a quartet, a foursome in the Pro-Am tournament, it's done usually by lot. In other words, the names are drawn, see? So that's all there is to it. So I came out to the golf course. This was down in Florida. So I came out to the golf course, and I figured I'd get some guy that's, running 249th on the tour, or maybe some guy who last year was kicked off the tour, but he's been called back to fill out the field and that stuff. And I couldn't believe it. Shepherd has just drawn the U.S. Master Champion, the guy that had just won the Masters. And I mean, one of the great money winners of all time. Let's put it this way. He was known at one time as the Bear, the Golden Bear, right? So, he's very cool. And I said, how are you? He said, it's okay. I said, that's the way I am. He said, I said, yeah, okay, you know. So we got into the golf cart. It was kind of nice. See, it's kind of nice to be going around. And our bags were right together. See, my golf bag was bumping up against his. And if you were more than 20 feet away, you couldn't have told a difference. They looked just as good. You know, your golf club looks just as good as anybody else's until you take it out of the bag and hold it, at which point... But here it is, you know, he's got this old battered bag. I got my old bag there. See, we're riding along there. And there's only one problem when you're dealing with that kind of a situation, see. Generally, when you're just out there playing with your friends Aki and Al and that kind of stuff, see, you can hold your own. You know, you feel pretty good about what you do. You get off a good one, you know. And uh, so Shepard gets up by the luck of the flip of the coin. Who's up first? Yeah, that's right, which is really bad news. So I step up to the tee there, and of course, 27 million people are out there, see, and because they want to see him, naturally, see. But there I am. I'm first up, and he's behind me, you know, he's waiting. He's got his driver there, and I look down the fairway. It's a 597-yard hole, you know, way like in the next county. I can see the flag down there. And they had more traps. I want to tell you, you had a feeling they were trying to catch wolverines or something there. They had a trap line that wouldn't stop. You know, there were little potholes with water around them. Some of the potholes had alligators in them. Some had piranha fish in the water. They had everything, see, so. and I might add that the rough had grass in it maybe 18, 20 feet high. And the actual fairway was maybe 6 or 7 feet wide. Just like a, wow, because, you know, the pros play there. See, they don't slice or hook or anything. So Shepard gets up to the tee, see, and I address the ball. I look around at the crowd. There's a ripple of applause. They had mistaken me for Orville Moody, at which point I kicked the dirt a little bit and spit. And see, because there had been a mistake in the scorecard. So at that point, Shepard takes his first swing. Well, you know, there are times when man rises to... You know, they always say that a man that gets elected to the presidency rises to the occasion. He becomes another man. Well, no, that's true. They do. I say, no, both good and bad. That's going to surprise a lot of you. No, that's right. See, we tend to think that, when you say he becomes a better man. Not necessarily. I've seen people turn into absolute maniacs the minute they were appointed manager of a radio station or something. Yeah, they started out, you know, the kind of guy that put dollar bills in the collection plate and all that. And 6 days after getting to be manager, they're grabbing dollar bills out of the collection plate when it goes by, you know. Hey, give me that money, you know. So they pressure turns you into something else. So Shepard walks up to the tee there, see, and the crowd, a ripple of applause. Okay, you want to hear what happened on the first tee? There must have been 120,000 people there, I'll tell you. Have you ever done something which you generally do in absolute private, followed by something they call the gallery? Oh, I'll tell you. You know, I'm used to that in showbiz, you know, when you perform before thousands of audiences all the time. That's something else. But when you're doing something that you ordinarily do and you're a little covert about it, if not apologetic, and suddenly you're followed by crowds of people. You know, it's like everybody has all come out to watch you take a shower. And, you know, they applaud every time, you know, you grab the life buoy and all. So anyway, I walked up to the tee, see, and there was a ripple of applause. I turned, you know, and I flicked my sunglasses down like all the pros do. And I had these shoes with the spikes. The whole works, see. Oh, yeah, with the gloves, all the fancy gloves. In fact, one of the great things about this pro-am was that they gave you the shoes. Yeah, that was the gift they gave you to come there and do this thing, see. So my shoes were absolutely the same shoes that were being used by this great pro. He had the same kind of shoes. And they were white, and they had this great big tongue that hung down with a gold thing on the front, you know, that says pro-am. And I had the glove with the white, in fact, it was red, had little red stripes on it, and had a great big gold seal on the back. And walks up to the, they gave everybody a dozen balls, too, see, with it said pro-am. Well, this is a very official thing. They had it stamped on a commemorative Tony Lima pro-am or whatever it was, see. So I steps up to the tee, and I places my $17 ball down there, and I spit in my $9 glove, and, you know, I kicked my $74 shoes into the dirt, and, you know, I flexed my my $3 driver, and, you know, the one that I got at Montgomery Ward. let me tell you this. I'm telling you, there's something to this presidential idea. Shepard leaned into one right down the fairway, see, and it was a zinger. I caught a hold of one of the best shots ever hit in my life, see. Well, I really laced it one, see, right down the fairway, see. And the gallery, no comment. They just sort of looked. And I really leaned into it. I just felt good about it. I just really belted it. And as I turned around, my partner, see, the big pro, as I turned around, he says, well, you'll get warmed up later. I mean, you'll get warmed up. He was serious, see? And I thought, what? You know, it was the best shot I'd gotten off, you know, since I was about, you know, 9 years old. I really laid one out there, see? So he turned, you know, very calm. Well, I did not realize the import of his words, you see, until he got off his drive. Well, I just want to tell you, friends, have you ever stood next to an F-11 when it's taken off? You know, that rush of air and that scream and all that? Well, that's the sound of his driver. I mean, he just had that neat swing, and it gathered momentum as it down. It went faster and faster until it went, whoosh, you know, that kind of goes, whoosh, click, you know, there's a little click, whoosh, like that. And I just saw that ball. I mean, my ball, where it was, see, I'd really hit a good one. And I even got a good roll, see. Well, his ball had just begun to climb when it was going over mine. Holy smokes. I realize that many are called, but damn few are chosen, friends, in that league. I mean, so, well, I did do one thing, though. I'll tell you this, see. So we're going all the way around, and Shepard is being very discreet. And, you know, it was a great feeling because now he's giving me tips, which, boy, I'll tell you, can you imagine what it would cost if I tried to pay him for that, you know? So he says, listen, he said, watch you there. He says, I want you to, he says, next time, he says, just bend your knees a little more. He said, drop your knees a little bit there. He says, you're standing a little too straight. He said, drop your knees a little. And he says, wait a minute. He says, give me a practice swing there now. So I go, you know, woof. And he says, well, he said, okay. So I'll tell you what you do now. He says, watch that left wrist now. He says, here. And so he reaches over and he grabs my wrist. He squeaks it, you know. I said, oh, wow. He said, okay. He said, now try it. He says, now hold that wrist. And so whoop. Well, I felt kind of great about that. See, he was doing it in private. See, the gallery had not caught up with us when they figured, you know, we were just having a friendly chat. So the gallery caught up. And here was Shepard now. He's laying in a trap. Well, I spent a good deal of time laying in a trap there. You're listening to a guy who's made a specialty out of getting out of traps. And, I'll tell you what I did. It's a trick, you know, the whole business of 2 inches back of the ball and all. See, so Shepard is back in this trap. I couldn't even see the pin. And I'm about 60 yards out of the pin, maybe 70 yards, 75 yards away from the pin, but in a trap off to the right and deep. And you see the green was on a hill that was a pitched green, see, that went only pitched away from the tee, strangely enough. You had to hit it over a lip and down, see, the real mean hole, see. And on the other side, it had a water hazard. It was kind of crescent-shaped. So if you pop this baby over the green, you know, it was goodbye ball, see. Either that or you get out the flippers and the snorkel gear and you start playing it from the bottom. So I'm way down in this hole, see. And nobody's paying any attention to me, obviously, see. So it's my turn to shoot. So I see this guy's head come over to, he's already, you know, he's on in two. Well, after all, it was a 700-yard hole. He had to take two shots at least on that one. So he's on in two, see. So I'm laying about 48, and I'm down in the sand down there, and the ball is half buried, see. And I'm very embarrassing to be holding up people of that nature. I mean, it's really discouraging that to have the quartet behind you. You see, is Lee Trevino. Trevino hollers something like, "Hey, senora, we play through, huh?" You know, it's not bad to have Lee Trevino play through you. You know, so I'm down there. But it's even better though to have to ask to play through Lee Trevino's quartet. That's even better. You know, you holler, "Excuse me, you're down in a trap, Lee. You mind if I go through?" You know, that kind of, it really makes you feel good. So I'm down in the trap there, see, and the guy looks down at me, and he says, okay, he says, line it up on that tree over there. I said, all right. So I look down in the sand, and there's this whole big ring of people all around the green, see. I'm afraid I'm going to brain somebody. So at that point, Shepard says, well, here goes nothing, and I've got, I'm using my wedge, see, and I dig in, boom, you know, sand, whoop. And I'm coughing the sand. The ball is gone. And I just see it disappear into the cloud of sand. There's a brief pause, and I hear this, wah! Shepard holds out from 70 yards out in the trap. Well, everything I did from that day on was anticlimactic. Didn't matter. In fact, This was on about the eighth hole, something like that. See, when I got back to the clubhouse, and there's this big crowd around the 18th green there, you know, and that's a great feeling, isn't it, with the 18th green laying down there, and you see this enormous gallery down there, and you're driving into that green, see. So, nevertheless, I go to the clubhouse, and this guy comes up to me, and later on, he's a big deal on the tour now, or, you know, semi-big deal. One of these guys that's always around eighth or ninth. You know, there's at least 30 golfers named Tommy. So, this guy comes up to me, and I didn't know who he was. He had this green T-shirt on, and sort of bronzed guy, and he says, are you the guy that holed out on the eighth there? From the trap to the right of the green there, 65 yards out? And I says, yeah, I guess I am. He says, boy, he says, I heard that was one hell of a shot. He said, what'd you use? I said, well, I used my Ben Hogan type wedge here, which let me take a look at that wedge. He says, it's not bad. He says, you mean you hold out with this? And I said, yeah, I did. And we kind of, you know, it was kind of nice to exchange little professional tips like that. He said, do you dig your back foot in? He says, do you hold it loose? I said, well, I prefer to dig it in. I dig in, you know. I said, after all, I was going for the pin. I knew I had to get in the pin at that one. See, I wasn't just trying to get up on the green. He says, oh, yeah. He said, well, I'll have to try that. Bum, ba-dum, bum. So you want to hear about the rest? No, you don't want to hear about the rest of that golf round, do you? I'll tell you this, though. It was the only time in my life I ever actually won anything playing golf. Yeah, you know, it was they did it on the basis of the score that the foursome got. And that's kind of nice when you got big guns going for you. Oh, boy. And, you know, it's... you know, speaking of champions, the only other time that I was ever involved with a true champion was really a great scene. I was in Ireland, and Ireland is a lot of... Like any other country, Ireland is highly, personal. If you go to, say, India... What you get on India, it depends entirely on your head. It does not depend on what kind of pictures you take with your Kodachrome slides and stuff. So it's extremely personal. Now, when I went to Ireland, I happened to be into horses, you know? Kind of casually, not a fanatic. I dig it, but yet on the other hand, I've never been a fanatic. What I'm about to tell you probably would drive a fanatic up the wall because, you know, a fanatic would say, oh, my God. So, nevertheless, by the way, please don't write me that letter. So, nevertheless, there's always somebody writing a letter. You're too fine a person. Well, I'm not too fine a person. You don't know anything about me. But, no, I'm really depraved. But, yes, decadent, right. Why do you think that I have... a subterranean subliminal appeal, because I reflect the decadence of our time, almost like a mirror image. You know, I frankly admit that I dig Big Macs, and you know, I sit and watch bad rotten television when a bad rotten movie isn't available, and you know, so what the heck. So nevertheless, I'm over in Ireland, see, and among other things, you know, how much time do I have, Dave? Please, quick. 7 minutes. Okay, I'll give you a tip. If you're looking for something really interesting to do this year, I think it's a little late for the spring show. There are two things to go to that I find fantastic in Europe. One of them is the spring show in Dublin, which is held very early in the spring. I think it's around the first 2 weeks of May, roughly, so we've missed that. But the spring show is like Ireland's all, let's say the entire country of Ireland's combined county fair. It's like if you took a national fair, really. We don't have any parallel in this country at all to it. But the spring show is 1 week, and it's a fantastic thing right in the middle of Dublin in this great big beautiful ancient arena, this ancient park called the Royal Dublin Enclosure. Actually, it's called the Royal Dublin Society Grounds, but the enclosure was within it, you see. The enclosure was where they do the events, And all around it is this ancient ground, and it's all Victorian. It goes back to roughly the last quarter century of Victoria's reign. It is truly Victorian. And it's exactly the way it was, except they've wired it for electricity. And that's about it. And these ancient buildings and these old, and they're beautiful. They're all magnificently maintained. And trees and great fields around. Right in the middle of town, there's these fields all around it and trees. And you can smell the animals that are there. It's just a great feeling. And that's the spring show. That's in the first couple of weeks of May. And then late in August, and this is something else, man, is the RDS, which is the capper to the Continental Horse Shows over the entire year of horse shows. That is, to begin early in the spring, go all the way through places like Aachen, places like Brussels, the famous horse shows in Germany, and of course the international teams go to these various horse shows. They're sent there by their country and so on. We're one of the very few countries, by the way, that does not nationally support its international jumping team. It's supported by individual contributions. So you go to Germany, and that's a German team. Germany provides the money. The Irish team is an Irish national team. It's provided by monies from Ireland. This is also true of the Italian team and so on. But we ours are strictly U.S. Jumpers, and it's all private funds. And in fact, even the horses are owned by private people who loaned them to the team. In case of people who are really benevolent, they give them to the team. But they're magnificent international jumpers. And so late in the summer, which is the best time of the year as far as weather is concerned in Ireland, in August, say, roughly, I think it's August the 4th. Last year it was. It's around that period. For 1 week, the RDS takes over, and that is fantastic. All the jumping teams from the continent come. And it's really, if you're looking for true color, this is truly it. All the farmers, for example, of all Ireland, have arrived with their prize donkey, which they are showing. Yeah, they have shows in all the different arenas. They show donkeys. They show all kinds of trotting horses. They show carriage horses. And this is a big competition for these people. they're wild-looking people, too, I might add, because these guys are coming from places where for, like, the entire year prior to this, the 1 week they spend in Dublin, they haven't even seen an electric light. You know, they live in a house that's covered with peat, and, they have a kerosene lamp, and they come into town with their prize bull or something. So here it is, the Royal Dublin Show. And then the final day of the RDS is the Ambassador's Cup, or rather the Nation's Cup, which is provided by, of course, Ireland. And they have the Royal Army Band out there, and the Premier and the President and the whole scene, and the flags are flying, and these teams are jumping in this enclosure. It's just a great sight. Every one of them, by the way, wearing their own individual colors. Obviously, the Irish team wears a green jacket. The U.S. team, by the way, wears a bright hunting pink, you would call it red. They call that a hunting pink. And it has a blue sort of a flash collar on it and white jodhpurs. That's the U.S. jumping colors with the black jumping hat. And very elegant with a big shield right on the pockets, a great big U.S. shield, you know. And you'd be surprised how patriotic all of a sudden you feel. When these guys come out, you know, there's four or five riders come out there on these great horses, and they're with the Italian team and the German team, and the world champion is always a German, you know, and they come out there, and the crowd cheers, and they play the Star Spangled Banner. Wow, you know, especially last year when an unbelievable upset, an 18-year-old U.S. rider beat the world champion for the cup, the Irish, the nation's cup, which is, you know, unbelievable. And a fantastic jump off, and the crowd was out of his bird. Well, that week, I had my involvement with a champion. I was out in the countryside later, about 2 days later, and this friend of mine who was into horses says, "You want to go riding?" And I said, "Do I want to go riding? Of course." See, so I was sent out to this place out in the country, outside of a town called Ennis, where they had a magnificent stable, fantastic stable of about 150 Irish jumpers of all kinds. These are all thoroughbreds, by the way. And the best Irish jumpers, well, in all of Ireland. And Ireland jumpers are just the best, see. And so I arrived out there, and this guy was waiting. A great big guy, looked a little bit like Gary Cooper, but with a raunchy Irish accent. I said, I'm ready to ride. He says, you can ride? And I said, yeah, I can stay on him. So with that, they bring out the biggest, most impressive horse. Seriously, the single most impressive horse I've ever seen in my life. It was snow white and 17 and a half hands high. Now, if you don't know much about that, this is a horse that makes, well, it dwarfs Wilt Chamberlain. And you know, I'm looking up at this horse. He's flicking his head. And 5 minutes later, I'm out in the field on this horse, which, by the way, had been a national jumping champion. And what a fantastic horse, you know. And you know, this is a champion, see. And I'm hanging on the back there. And we're moving along, and I'm riding. And the guy says, quite soft on the mouth. And I says, yes. And just a little flick, you know, and the horse moves. He just knows what he's doing, see. And we're going out, and the rain is coming down, and all that Irish green all around, and there's a flock of sheep to the left of us, and the bull looking real mad through the undergrowth at us to the right. And the horse is looking at the bull, and we just move on through that countryside, and I says, my God, this is a real champ. And by the way, this horse has appeared on the cover of Vogue. This horse has been photographed in dozens of pictures. In fact, this horse was used by Richard Burton in one of the Shakespearean films that they made. Unbelievable horse. Oh, you know, you got to go first class if you're going to go, you know.
By recording from New York, you've been listening to Inside Gene Shepherd. Join us.